Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. You know, I wanted to talk to Alice Sebald before The Almost Moon got published, and so this interview is being taped 2 months before its pub date because I feel absolutely sure that this book is going to be causing a lot of argument, talk, enjoyment, conversation. I think it's great when there's a difference of opinion. That's what literature is meant to provoke. And so I wanted to talk before all the fuss started getting made. Now, the title, The Almost Moon, appears in the book when a woman who we learn on the very first page has just killed her mother, is talking, remembering a talk with her father about the moon, that the moon is always full, but you don't see it. You may see only a sliver of it. And I thought that perhaps this book was written to present as full a reading of characters who mostly keep themselves in the shade, like the moon, and are very rarely fully exposed. Exposure seems to be one of the metaphors of this book.
I think, like many writers, I like to listen to you talk about my book. I would agree with that, and I think that after writing it, one of the things that was just very hard to sit with is the amount of isolation that each character experiences while they're ardently trying to, make connection. But they experience connection as ultimately painful. And so it's this mixed bag of true intimacy should not seemingly be painful, but they experience it that way, particularly the main character, Helen, with her mother.
Well, for years, Helen has been able, in a sense, to feel that she's lived an open life. After all, doesn't she model nude for art students? Doesn't she have a wild sense of humor, one that has prevented her from seeing beneath it the presence of a first-class bitch? And so she has been, in a sense, protected by her daughterly duty to a mother who's even more first class than she is. And so it's not until this extraordinary act occurs on the first page that the fissures in her character begin to open up, and she sees and we see how much intimate parental control has determined character.
Yeah, I was looking at a print earlier today by this Japanese printmaker, Yoshitoshi, and it's titled, Parental Fidelity, and it's a picture of a young boy being approached by a train. And, you know, my husband and I were talking about, how is that really parental fidelity? But I love that an image that's hundreds of years old could come and work so perfectly for us, which is that idea that if you stay alone on that track, you're ultimately going to be mowed down by it. And I mean, I'm aware that that idea goes very much against how we're raised to believe a close relationship with your parent can be or should be. But I think for a very long time, I've always struggled against the idealized versions of those relationships. Most of the adult people that I know have come to peace with their parents, not started at peace with their parents. And that's a huge distinction to me.
Yes, in her case, her name is Helen Knightley. She has been married. She has two children. And now here she is in her mid-40s. She's taking care of her mother, an 88-year-old woman named Claire, who is as fierce as she was when Helen was growing up, as frightened as she was, nearly a lifelong agoraphobic. Mm. And Helen has been living out her fidelity and keeping it a secret that her father has committed suicide, something that we know early on in the book. In other words, what we're going to do is watch a woman move out of reactiveness into self-understanding of some very difficult kind.
Exactly. And I think that the book starts with the action of killing her mother, because it really is taking what I think is the essential metaphor of freeing yourself from your parent, whether you actually kill them or not, and making it real in fiction. And so her freedom, which is a dangerous place, starts with her action on the first page. And since we're with her for 24 hours, we find just the beginning of the threads of that. And, you know, I've had some early reaction from booksellers, and it's ranged from, well, who hasn't wanted to kill their mother, to, well, obviously this is a portrait of pure mental illness. And, you know, I think that people's responses to the idea of the book, you know, they can, regardless of their responses to how it's written or anything like that, I think their responses to the idea of the book really reflect some essential ideas that they need to hold true in order to get through their lives. You know, there's so much denial about the relationship between particularly an older middle-aged adult and their quite elderly parent, in order just to day by day take care of that elderly parent, that we need to see it in a softer light than it actually exists in.
Now, it seems to me that from your very first writing, whether instinctively or in the process of learning your art and your craft, you've decided that the things that cannot be said, the taboo, the unspeakability of certain subjects, must be broken by the writer. And so the first book is a fearless memoir of a rape and a prosecution of the rape that occurred when you were in college. The second book, The Lovely Bones, is on a similar subject, but with a child who is already dead and is narrating this from beyond the grave and who is no longer afraid of telling exactly what happened. And now in this book, we begin not only with the death of the mother, the murder of the mother, but those horrible things that we all fear, washing the mother. The mother has had what the woman on the first page will call an accident, although her language becomes less gentle as she goes along. But the cleaning up process and the going through all of the horrible things that the mother, living indoors for so many years, has hoarded and kept food in freezers downstairs that's years and years old, old Christmas hams, candy she wouldn't allow herself to eat, or even cooked herself and then froze. This whole metaphor is almost like the breaking of what Kafka calls that frozen sea that hides the unbearable thing within. And the book is kind of bravely going into the realm of the frozen and the unbearable.
Well, it's funny because I think it's a reflection for me. The physicality of the first, I guess it's 100 pages during which she's bathing her mother after she's killed her and reflecting back on the past, really to me is the other side of the original physicality, where you're born to your mother and you suckle at her breast and it's effused with this warmth, that whole process. And on the other side of it is a whole nother relationship where you are You know, even if you do not kill your mother, you are the person who is, you know, there to take care of and see out that person that you loved, your parent. So there, the physicality in the bathing scene for me is in some way a mirror for the physicality of the infant's relationship to the parent. And then when you get into all the food hoarding and the strange relationship with that, I think that that also is this idea of, you know, the thing that nurtures is also the thing that poisons, which is, again, a commentary on the parent-child relationship.
Because as much as people's reaction may reflect their own relation to their parents, as a writer's task, Helen breaks free of convention on the first page. And we're told again and again by various characters in different situations, the rules are off. And so within the first, oh, I would say quarter of the book, Helen has not only killed her mother, but has had sex with her best friend's 30-year-old son. Not just had sex, but seduced him.
And well, if you're going to free fall, you might as well have some fun on the way down.
Well, yeah. Well, she. But there's a kind of feeling of falling, of gravitylessness, of escaping the bounds of self.
Right.
And it makes the reader feel, if they're not busy clucking their tongues, feel kind of giddy and free. Him or herself. I mean, I found myself calling friends and saying, I've just experienced one of those things that can happen in novels. I don't feel like my inhibitions are in place.
I would actually say that's a great thing for me to hear, because I do think that that's part of the result of taking a psychological arc that if you face the issues with your problematic parent, or even sometimes an unproblematic parent, if you face those issues, you do end up in dark fantasies and dark places, things that you know you would never do, wishes that you would never hope came true. But what happens if somebody who is not horribly different from you actually does do those things? And so, you know, Helen is that person. And so you get to both take the ride with her of this experience and also know that you have not actually enacted any of your dark fantasies. So it's an interesting kind of, you know, 24-hour ride of your dark fantasy where you can walk away and you're like, nothing's sticking to me. I'm not guilty.
Well, it's nice, especially because usually in the movies, these things happen as the culmination of a fantasy. Take Thelma and Louise at the climax of a movie. Here, the woman is freed from anything we might expect of her from the very first page of the book. I mean, I don't think I've read the sentence, but by now I'm sure it has become a famous one. When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. Did it come easily to you when writing it?
No, I think that the struggle for me always is to find the voice to tell the story that I know I want to tell. And that can take me a few years. And I have a few close readers, and I was showing them pages through those years. And I felt, and though they were positive and encouraging, because that's what you have friends for, when I would say, after their positive, encouraging remarks, well, you know, this feels a little bit too much like some very nice people at a cocktail party. It doesn't feel like it's taking any risks. It doesn't feel difficult to me. And I don't mean difficult to read or difficult to understand. I mean, I don't really feel as if I'm putting myself up against it as a writer, and nor are my characters up against it. It all seems way too pleasant. And they would just kind of bashfully nod their heads. That yes, indeed, that was true. And, you know, so I think before I even showed my work to my friends, I'd always know, well, this is okay. And I'm sure given the success of Lovely Bones, I could finish the story and it would be published. But that wasn't what I wanted. I really search for, if I'm going to spend a few years with somebody carrying me through dark thoughts, I want to really like that character. And liking, meaning have her be, you know, articulate and perverse and, you know, just interesting enough and also sympathetic enough from my point of view to carry me through all that dark material.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Alice Siebold, author most recently of The Almost Moon, published by Little Brown. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Alice Siebold about her new novel, The Almost Moon. Now, I feel often in your books that there's a kind of challenge to the reader. Are you going to shut down, or will you open to this book? And the characters as well, because this character has to tell her husband, her ex-husband, and her younger daughter, we see it happening face to face. She not only has to tell what's happened, that she's killed her mother, she has to shut up and let the person respond and see what the response is. And those challenges mirror what the reader is going through. How do I respond to material that has taken me out of my comfort zone?
I think that's probably a pretty accurate summation of my existence on the planet Earth. In that I feel like I was always, even, you know, before I was raped at 18, that even as a kid, I was the one who was interested in, you know, the worm under the rock as opposed to the flower above it. And it was because I was always sure that there was something, a greater thing, a more interesting thing under the rock than there was above it. And then I think when I was raped, it's very black and white, or at least it was in my experience. You have two choices, tell no one, hope no one finds out, repress it all, or tell people in completely inappropriate moments and with a consistency that makes sure that someone is going to respond in a way that is ultimately helpful to you, either with their own narrative or just by saying, yeah, that really sucks. I mean, you know, the challenge of response should never be, I mean, in other words, when a writer challenges you, my feeling is they should never challenge you in a way that says, you know, what are you going to do about it? Or, you know, just something hostile. The challenge should be a friendly challenge. Here is this. I give it to you completely open. You know, it's yours to do what you want with. So that's why I'm always shocked, say, when somebody has such a passionate and negative response to an idea that I've written about or spoken of, because it's only given to you as a gift. And if you don't want to receive it, you know, that's the wonderful thing about the private world of reading is you don't have to receive it. It's not being forced upon you.
Well, at the same time, you know, Helen and her mother, Claire, have felt different times as they watch the people in the old home neighborhood age. That's going to happen to them, not to me. And so, you know, what goes on in this book is that all kinds of barriers are torn open by a primal gesture, the murder of a parent. We're told mythologically that the murder of a parent and the destruction of the children. After all, the gods ate their children. The Titans turned against. You know, it's the origin of myth. But here we are in Pennsylvania.
Oh, that's the origin of myth.
And what happens from page one of the book is a whole series. We don't want to think about our parents aging. but we have to. We don't want to think about them dying. And thinking about them, thinking about ourselves killing them, and who hasn't fantasized it, takes us beyond the painful pragmatism of taking care of parents into the mythic level. The whole unconscious or superego encountering this material, everything comes tumbling loose. That's what I found so interesting, that you can control the narrative, but you can't control my response to the narrative, which involves, you know, I'm witnessing a lot of primal and unbearable, frightening stuff. And the character's voice, which is hilariously funny most of the time, isn't consoling me because she is the murderess.
Right. Right. I mean, I would say that idea is very exciting to me, that and I think that that's exactly the relationship I would want with a reader, which is I put something out there and the reader has his or her own relationship to it. And, you know, I'm so upset with a lot of the way I see particularly American fiction going, which is very much about the clever book, or it's a book that it doesn't feel like it creates a space for the reader. It's a performance. It's not an engagement. And so there's something about my work that I'm hoping the reader engages with, however they do that. You know, that's their thing. But that's the idea of, you know, maybe ultimately the reciprocity in my life that is greatest is the quiet one between myself and a reader.
Well, I think also one of the things that American fiction has been playing with recently is the numbness of Americans in the face of all kinds of catastrophe. And so the zombie character, the character who's doing things beyond explanation, beyond control, in a language of complacency, this has created a strange kind of sedative fiction in which
it makes the reader, you know, feel reassured that they're not a zombie because the character they're reading about is more of a zombie than them.
Yes, exactly. And the precondition of your books is that you're going to break the routines associated with numbness.
Yeah, I think it's for me, I find it, you know, personally, I find that essential. And the only way also for me that I find that's possible is to constantly look for the difficult stuff, try to understand it. And so, you know, so far, I have always, for years now, I've always said to my husband, you know, when am I going to write the fluffy, happy hippie, which is our little like title of the book of, you know, just humorous, light stuff that one day I will write. But, you know, in some sense, I hope never to write the fluffy, happy hippie, because these investigations are what is most vital to me and what keeps me alive on the planet, and also really, really frustrated with most human interaction, which is not of a depth that I wish it were.
A final question. Because I'm very familiar with The Lovely Bones, in The Almost Moon, when Claire, the mother, is killed, I thought that she might return, because in the earlier book, that is possible. And certainly, it's an idea that could have occurred to this author because she did it in a previous book. Did you feel the impulse to, what would you say, apologize for your character by allowing the mother a second round? I mean, what was the emotional upheaval in you as a result of doing this?
That's a complicated question. I would say that there is a moment in the book after Helen kills her mother and she's had sex with her best friend's son, and she finds herself back at her own house, and she's lying down on the lawn before she goes into her house. and looking up at the stars and thinking about, you know, her mother. And she makes some comment about how her mother is not up there looking down at her. And so I think in that line, when I wrote it, I had known before, but I knew that that was a line that could never have come out of, you know, the main character or the philosophical life of The Lovely Bones. This was a different book. You know, it's as simple as that in my mind. But it was very comforting for me because it meant that I had traveled a good distance as well.
Mm. And but as you were writing, did you experience the emotional, the psychic upheavings that I tended to experience while reading it? Not the same sure. ones.
Yes, and it was a very, in its way, I mean, each book I've written has been difficult, but in its way, this book was extremely difficult because I also knew and hoped that at the end of it, if I were ever to finish it, one of the first readers would be my own mother. You know, hats off to her because she's a good reader and can deal with challenging material. But I was working with a lot of difficult stuff. So, yes, I definitely went through that ride of upheaval.
Has she survived the reading of the book? What did she
yes,
say?
She unfortunately, I was not at home when she finished, so she called and talked to my husband for a while, and so I missed that first rush. But when I did get to talk to her, the first thing she said is, "Some people may need to make fictional characters into real ones. I do not. You've written a marvelous book."
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, she's a reader first, you know, and I'm her kid.
I've been talking with Alice Siebold, author most recently of The Almost Moon, published by Little Brown. Thank you, Alice, for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. We have special thanks to the recording engineer Seal at KQED in San Francisco. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.